from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In Baghdad, a new draft constitution seems to have both made and missed a second deadline last night, with key issues still in dispute. In Salt Lake City, Utah, President Bush interrupted his August vacation to speak to a national convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, saying again that the war in Iraq is a central front in the war on terror. For the first time, the president spoke aloud the number of war dead in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We've lost 1,864 members of our armed forces in Operation Iraqi Freedom and 223 in Operation Enduring Freedom. Each of these men and women left grieving families and loved ones back home.
And then the president held up those deaths to give his bottom line.
We owe them something. We will finish the task that they gave their lives for.
But across the country, what the U.S. should do next in Iraq has become the subject of an ever more lively debate, with critics in both parties now saying it's time to find the exits. This hour on Point, as the Iraqis struggle with their constitution, we're talking about the newly live debate over the Iraq War and whether it's time to dig in or get out. We will hear in a few minutes from retired General William Odom, who says it's time to go, and also from Stay the Course advocates. But first, we begin with the situation in Iraq. Dan Murphy is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from Baghdad, where things have been deeply snagged up on the Constitution drafting front. Dan, what's the fundamental dynamic that has the Constitution still in play after the deadline?
Well, I mean, they postponed it again. It was a semantic tap dance to not call the postponement, but they don't have a finished draft yet, and the finished draft isn't submitted. They say they're going to do that on Thursday. The reason why is because Iraq's minority Sunni Arab politicians, at any rate, and it seems most of their community, are opposed to the notion that Iraq will be a federal state with weak central powers and a very strong autonomous governments in places like Kurdistan and perhaps the Shiite deep south of the country. There is almost no chance that the Sunnis will come around in the next 3 days. So essentially the dynamic is trying to find a way to get buy-in from the community whose members form the vast majority of the insurgency here without losing the patience of the Shiites and the Kurds who want a deal done quickly.
Does it look as though there's room for compromise here, or will the Kurds and Shiites with their majority in the parliament simply step over the Sunnis and do what they want with this constitution?
I think it's the latter. You know, Shiite political leaders in particular say they've bent over backwards to, they say they've compromised as far as they can compromise, and they still haven't satisfied, you know, what they describe as an intractable Sunni position, and they could have a point. The Sunni political leaders have two problems. They have almost no seats in the parliament because they didn't participate in the January 30th election. There was a boycott then. And the second problem is they're terrified of the very violent members of their community who very likely might try to kill them if they sign something away in their name. What they would like to do is, as you said, gum this whole process up and force fresh elections at which they'd expect to participate and have much more representation and then begin the constitutional process. So, you know, there's almost no chance that a satisfactory compromise will be found this week.
Dan, the president has described this just yesterday in his speech as landmark movement forward on the Constitution. And, of course, supporters of the president say if the U.S. pulls out of Iraq, there is the imminent risk of civil war there. So progress, and if the U.S. pulls back, does that mean civil war?
I don't know what landmark movement means. What I do know is that Iraq, more or less, is already in the middle of a civil war. We have a largely Shiite security establishment fighting against a largely Sunni Arab insurgency with a very high death tolls over political power and territory inside Iraq. If that's not a civil war, I don't know what is. Now, the question is do we get a Lebanese situation where it becomes a really nasty and bloody conventional civil war? Or is there a way to keep the lid on it at these levels and finally get people moving towards some common ground? I'd like to believe so. Personally, if I was king for a day, I don't know what I would do at this point. Clearly, if you were to pull out American troops tomorrow, there would be major trouble. keeping them here and simply staying the course doesn't seem to be a recipe for bringing Iraqis together either. So where the answer is now is a great mystery, unfortunately.
Dan, you know, back in the States, the debate over whether to stay or go to plan an exit strategy with the calendar seems to get hotter by the day. Are Iraqis following that American debate? And how does Iraqi sentiment break down on the issue of whether American troops should stay or should be withdrawn?
People are having this debate amongst themselves, and you will even find Sunni leaders now who were opposed to the invasion, are pretty anti-American in their rhetoric, saying they wouldn't want to see an immediate American withdrawal tomorrow at this point because of the rise of the Shiite militias and the security services that the Americans now sort of provide a restraining hand on when they seek to assassinate Sunni political leaders and so forth. What people think about it is I find everything from people saying the Americans are the source of all our problems, which I think from an Iraqi is a misreading of the situation, because there's no chance the violence would stop simply if the Americans left, to other people saying, look, we do need them to hold things together now, and then a third camp that says, yes, maybe some sort of time frame would be a good idea, so at least we can get some of the fence sitters in the Sunni community over into participating in politics, build a really strong army, and find a solution. I don't have a strong opinion about what the right answer is. It's a mess at the moment, and unfortunately it's grown more dangerous and less stable, I feel, with each passing month this year.
A mess, and with divided opinion on both sides of the planet. Dan Murphy in Baghdad, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Dan Murphy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, joined me from Baghdad. We turn now to Boise, Idaho, and Los Angeles Times White House correspondent Peter Walston. He was with the president yesterday for his speech to the VFW convention in Salt Lake City. Peter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Describe the scene in the hall, if you would, for us yesterday. 15,000 VFW members. What kind of reception did they give the president, and what was the president's tone?
Well, it was an overwhelmingly positive reception. Obviously, it's a friendly crowd. It's veterans who have maintained their affiliation in some way with the military and are inclined to support the commander in chief. And they gave him repeated ovations and rousing applause. And I talked to several of them afterwards who were touched by the president's insistence on kind of maintaining and forging ahead with the effort in Iraq.
Meanwhile, outside that hall, public opinion polls find Americans only 38% now support the president's handling of Iraq, and he has prominent members of his own party, Senator Chuck Hagel, saying this looks more and more like Vietnam, we're making a mess of things over there. How is the White House reading the national mood? Does the president think he can bullhorn support back up on his Iraq strategy?
Well, it seems as though the White House is responding to that. The president, this was his first public appearance in 9 days, and his first comment on his first kind of formal speech on Iraq in some weeks. So there's a recognition by the White House that they have a problem. Also, it seems that the protest by Cindy Sheehan in Crawford and now other military other mothers of dead soldiers has taken on a life of its own in a way that the White House probably wasn't expecting. And of course, it coincided with the president being largely out of public view. So they recognize they have a problem, and so the president gave his speech yesterday, and he'll be speaking again about the war on terrorism tomorrow in Idaho. I saw some White House officials hitting the TV circuit this morning to talk about it. We'll see, I'm sure, an upswing in the White House trying to reverse this tide of public opinion. The question is, they've done this before, and it's always kind of faded away. So the question is, do they have the ability to turn it around, or will it just continue? Will public opinion continue to slide against them?
You've got Newt Gingrich now saying that Republicans need to talk boldly about a 50-to-70-year war with Islamic radicalism. You've got the Army's top general, Peter Shoemaker, talking about a worst-case scenario of U.S. troops there for 4 more years. The president earlier poo-pooed notions of a pullout of troops next summer. He said we'll stay as long as we have to. What's the message that the White House thinks may elicit more confidence from the American public?
Well, the White House, you know, they don't really have much choice right now. The president can't change his policy. It's not been his way to change his policy based on public opinion, and they're not likely to do it anytime soon. So, but on the other hand, all they can do is try to sell the war to the public. It's not, and so far that hasn't been working. There's obviously a disconnect between the defense that the White House is offering and public opinion, and the more that disconnect persists, the more trouble they're in, and that's one factor that could contribute to problems for Republican candidates in elections next year, and frankly, for the presidential election in 2008. Now, the Republicans have done a great job of building a majority over the past 15 or 20 years in this country. This Iraq war is one possible wild card that could reverse that tide.
Henry Kissinger, a voice from the Vietnam War era past, showing up in the Washington Post 10 days ago saying, watch out, you don't want the hallmarks of Vietnam to get all over this. You don't want public opinion to slip away, and that looks like the struggle right now. Peter Walston in Boise, Idaho, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Peter Walston, LA Times White House correspondent, author of the forthcoming book, One Party Country. He joined me from Boise. We are talking about the U.S. and Iraq and whether it's time to dig in or get out. You can join the conversation. What should the U.S. do? What are the implications now of staying, of going? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking, as Iraq struggles with its constitution, about the newly live U.S. debate, whether it's time to dig in or look to get out of Iraq. In Salt Lake City yesterday, the president was clear on what he wants, talking about the requirement before Americans should leave.
As we hunt down our common enemies, we will continue to train more Iraqi security forces so they can take on more responsibilities in fighting the terrorists. After all, it's their own country. Our military strategy is straightforward. As Iraqis stand up, Americans will stand down. And when Iraqi forces can defend their freedom by taking on more and more of the fight to the enemy, our troops will come home with the honor they have earned.
That is a pretty picture, but not everyone's confident it's going to happen that way. What do you think? What needs to happen before the U.S. leaves Iraq? President Bush says U.S. troops will stand down when Iraqi troops stand up. Are you prepared to wait for that? What does it mean to finish the job in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined right now from Lincoln, Vermont, by retired Lieutenant General William Odom. He's former director of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, now a professor at Yale, author of America's Inadvertent Empire. General Odom, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You have been saying for a while now that the U.S. should get out of Iraq, but you know there's a long list of objections to getting out, and I think many Americans are frankly confused about what the implications would be of doing that. Number one on that list currently seems to be if the U.S. leaves, Iraq descends into civil war, the region potentially descends into chaos. What do you say to that?
Well, you just heard the reporter from Iraq say that they have a civil war in Iraq now. If you understood, which we should have been able to do very easily before the war started, our invasion would break up the political system, and a civil war was inevitable. So we're in a position where we've done something that's irretrievable. There is a civil war. Whether we stay or leave, there will be a civil war. So to say we can't leave because there will be a civil war is simply self-deception. And the longer you stay, the more you contribute to it.
But our reporter this morning, Dan Murphy, speaking to us from Baghdad, did say that there's some elements of constraint on what you might call a civil war there now, that it hasn't come to the place of Lebanon, let's say, with its long, straight-up civil war. I think Americans, many, see what you're talking about, what he's talking about, and yet imagine it might be far worse if U.S. troops go, and that it might spill right over the borders of Iraq into neighboring countries, into the oil fields that the world economy depends on. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that that's going to happen anyway, or some of those things are going to happen anyway. He also said that things have gotten worse. And that's the point. We may be slowing down one type of civil war, but we're allowing preparations for another kind of war. For example, the Iranians are building capabilities among the Shiites so that when we do leave, they will dominate, the Shiites will dominate the scene. So we may be changing the timing of some of this violence, but we made this inexorably the case once we invaded. To sit here and talk about staying in longer to keep it from happening is like somebody who just shot a person and said, I can't afford to have committed murder. Well, you did.
We're not done.
So this is a nonsense discussion, a complete nonsense discussion.
And yet, it's the President of the United States that's making the case. There's more of the practical implications I want to look at, but what about the big issue of American credibility? The President says these men and women have died for this goal, and you hear other supporters of the effort saying the country's credibility is on the line here globally. If it pulls out now, after this big intervention, it looks feckless.
Well, the President's the Commander-in-Chief, and he made the decision, and he has to bear the responsibilities for the deaths. If he wasted those lives, that is his fault. And there isn't, by losing more lives, we don't make these lives lost more valuable. We make them more valuable by losing fewer lives.
And the credibility issue?
And the credibility issue. If we were a small country or a weak country like Russia or an obstreperous country like France, credibility might be an issue. We are so strong that credibility is not an issue for us. We're going to be less credible the more power we squander by staying longer. We have already hurt our credibility enormously. An unprecedented drop in U.S. influence and credibility in the world has occurred because we invaded Iraq. I don't see how staying in causes our credibility to increase.
The President says this is a central front on the war, in the war on terror. There's clearly a threat. The United States has been hit before, others, London recently, and the fear is raised that Iraq would become a super haven for terrorists if U.S. troops pull out.
I said before the war that one of the main things we would achieve by invading is to make Iraq safe for al-Qaeda, which it was not then. I mean, this is pure nonsense that we're hearing. I mean, we created the al-Qaeda problem in Iraq by invading. Saddam hated al-Qaeda. So do the Iranians and a number of other of these hardline rulers in the Middle East. The idea of a war on terrorism is a confusing concept. Terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy. I don't know how to fight terrorism. I like my terrorists. I don't like your terrorists. It's like trying to declare war on night attacks.
But let me ask you, I understand you think...
Just a minute, let me
just point
out.
Yes, sir, yes, sir.
The war in Iraq was not against al-Qaeda. It was against Saddam. So we don't lower the terrorist problem by fighting Saddam. We've increased it. Therefore, getting out of Iraq is a precondition to getting some allies together with us which could do something that might stabilize the larger region.
Mm-hmm.
So we are playing right in to al-Qaeda's hands by staying there longer. We played into it massively by invading Iraq in the first place. The two parties who gained the most from this war have been the Iranians, who hated Saddam for invading them in 1980, and Osama bin Laden, who couldn't have been more pleased that we destroy a secular leader and make it possible for a radical Islamic regime to succeed him in Iraq.
Well, paint a picture then for us. What is to keep the whole Middle East from becoming enveloped in violence if U.S. troops leave? You've got then a kind of new battlefront between, potentially, if it's seen that way, between Shia and Sunni. What's going to keep Syria and Saudi Arabia and the whole region from becoming engulfed in violence?
It's entirely possible that may happen, but our staying in will not prevent it. Our staying in is merely causing the fuse to burn faster. This radicalization of the region is a product of our initiating the war. And that's you cannot escape that basic fact.
So, but why give up on President Bush? President Bush is saying, let's get a democratic process going here and let's stick with the Iraqis until their own security troops can stand up and handle the security situation there. We'll stand down when they stand up.
I was hoping you'd ask me that question. That was exactly our strategy in Vietnam, and we trained up military forces, and they were pretty good forces. training the military forces is not a solution to the problem. A political consolidation, which they are not able to get, as you've just heard over the negotiations for the Constitution, is the problem. A military, if it could be trained up effectively, would take over as it did in Vietnam. We know that when military modernization in the Third World gets ahead of political consolidation, you have military dictatorships and continuing civil war in the countries that have these regimes. Now, that's exactly what happened in Vietnam. First place, I don't think we'll have very much success in training the Iraqis, because not because they can't fight, it's because to whom are they going to be loyal? Military consolidation requires confidence in the military organizations you're fighting with, and they have to be responsible to some kind of political leadership that you know can deliver. Any Iraqi knows he's risking his life to join any of these particular groups. Therefore, there isn't anything we can do in a training program over there that's going to make this better. And if training were the problem, how would we explain that those untrained insurgents are pretty effective fighters? This is really not a military training problem. This is a political consolidation problem, and it can't be consolidated because of the points you just heard earlier. The Kurds cannot make the concessions necessary. The Sunnis will not make them, and the Shiites think they're going to get the whole piece of cloth, so they're not going to make any. Those kinds of problems are solved by wars, and we set up the situation, and a war is going to solve it, and we're not going to solve it by voting. We didn't solve it in our country with our own constitution until we fought from 1861 to 1865, the bloodiest war of our history, in proportions of casualties of the population. So the idea that you will have a nice voting procedure achieve a constitutional breakthrough in Iraq under American aegis just boggles the mind. There's no historical precedent for that.
Okay, here is a very grim view then, but can the United States just walk away and say, all right, boys, fight it out, and we'll look back when it's over and see where the world's energy supplies are, see where the Middle East is? What is your – fill us in on your strategy. If you want to get out, how would you do it without apocalypse here?
You may have an apocalypse no matter what because of our initial entry into the war. There are some things you could do, and I think laying out a set of policy steps that one would take right now don't make any sense for me to do. I can give you sort of another illustrative things in a general way that need to happen.
Okay.
Getting out in a hurry doesn't mean getting out in 2 weeks, but it means getting out pretty quickly. And that will certainly quicken the sense of the incentives for some kinds of settlements to be made among the parties in Iraq, if it's possible to make them.
But you describe it not as a path to settlement, but to arming up.
I don't think they will make them, and I think you'll have that war anyway, but who knows? The next thing, what getting out will allow the U.S. to do that it cannot do now is to restore some kind of better relations with Europe. The Europeans have far more to fear from this thing going into the kind of scenario you've been describing than we do. And therefore, I think our withdrawal, our commitment to withdrawal, going to the United Nations and saying, if we can get some kind of UN-blessed coalition that wants to take our place or devise a strategy that's larger for the whole region, including the Arab-Israeli issue, the issue of Taliban in Afghanistan, Iran, and so forth, we're prepared to support that. Now, I think you would begin to get a lot of contributions from the heavy players in the world in Europe. I also think Japan and even China might make constructive contributions here. They have as much or more to lose from oil, et cetera, than we do.
But it's hard to picture how that weight is going to add up to the U.S. weight when its overwhelming military power is deployed here, and what diplomacy is going to do with these very tough issues on the ground. General Odom, if you could stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Joining us from Indianapolis, Indiana, Thomas Barnett. He's former professor at the U.S. Naval War College, author of the Pentagon's new map and the forthcoming Blueprint for Action, A Future Worth Creating. Thomas Barnett, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the country is scratching its head as the bloodletting goes on, trying to figure out what to do here. We heard the president yesterday say, hang in there. We won't stand down until the Iraqis stand up. We hear Republican Senator Lindsey Graham saying the worst-case scenario is not staying 4 more years. The worst-case scenario is leaving a dysfunctional, repressive government behind. What should happen in Iraq, Thomas Barnett?
Well, I think we have to be realistic about what we set in motion. As General Odom indicated, you came in and took out the authoritarian leadership of a very unitary state, a very repressive regime that had achieved the integration of three very disparate and antagonistic, mutually antagonistic cultures through a very heavy-handed dictatorship over decades. You remove that leader, there's a lot of bad blood, a lot of scores to be settled. Not surprisingly, we've seen violence since. The positive part is that we have the buy-in from the Kurds, who have effectively governed themselves quite well over the last decade.
Well, we have buy-in for their own autonomy, but beyond
right.
that, it's not included.
And we got buy-in from the Shiites. So two out of three basically buy into the notion that we're going to have a federated state with without a strong central control in terms of dictating the economic and political futures of those various components. The
so
people
does that
do
mean
not
we've essentially
agree with this are the Sunnis.
But does that mean we're essentially have overseen the breakup of Iraq?
Sure. Just like we oversaw the breakup of Yugoslavia. When you take an artificial state like Iraq and remove the power that had been holding the entities together, frankly, against their will and with a lot of violence, killing hundreds of thousands over decades, you're going to see a natural explosion there. You're going to see that fake state decompose into its original constituent parts.
Then what's the course away from civil war? The Sunnis are not exactly a puny minority. They've got us all tied up in knots just with a guerrilla war. How does the U.S. keep this from continuing a slide toward what everyone this morning is describing as a kind of nation or more civil war right now?
You're not going to stop the Sunnis from fighting against the dream of keeping some sort of unitary state. What you're going to have to do is create a sense of inevitability, which I think they're doing quite effectively, with the notion that the Kurds and the Shiites are moving on, and what the Sunnis face over time is a decreasing bargaining position unless they bring themselves to some sort of capacity for self-rule and accept the notion that they're not going to have the kind of state or the kind of influence they had before. The Kurds are going to have access to oil. The Shiites are going to have access to oil. The Sunnis are going to have a hard economic lot in that scenario. And not surprisingly, there are big chunks of that population that are willing to fight against that scenario from unfolding. But this, I agree with General Olam, this is all inevitable. This is going to happen whether we're there or not. The question is, how are we going to speed this process up? If we remove ourselves from it, I think we drag it out over time. And what we set in motion is a retrenchment of some very positive gains that we've seen in the Middle East over the last 6 to 8 months in terms of elections and movements towards democracy and more pluralism in countries where regional experts had told us for years, and right up till the very events occurred early this year, that none of these things were possible. The Bush administration did set in motion what they like to describe as a big bang in the Middle East. The trick now is not only to solidify and move beyond the situation in Iraq, but frankly to involve a lot of regional players in the situation. My problem with the discussion is that we make it such a mono-mono thing. What is America getting out of this? You can't solve Iraq in isolation. If you're going to have a more autonomous Kurds, you're going to have to deal with the Turks. If you're going to have a more autonomous Shiite population, you're going to have to find some modus vivendi with Iran.
So it's a bigger.
You're going to have to get somebody to own the Sunnis.
It's a bigger and bigger bang. General Odom, we've just got a half minute before the break, but Tom Barnett says you've got to cow or entice the Sunnis into accepting essentially the breakup of Iraq. Can that be done?
No, not in any reasonable time. And but I agree with most of what he says. What I disagree with is that we've got a democratization process that's going to make things better in the Middle East. We're going to have illiberal democracies that are tyrannies like Iran, and they're going to be very hostile to the United States, much more hostile than what we've had even in the 1980s with Saddam. And therefore, I don't see... I agree that we should get more people involved in doing something about it, and that was my earlier point about the preconditions for getting more people involved is for us to get out and get the Europeans and others involved.
General Odom, Thomas Barnett in Indianapolis, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. Listeners, you can join us. Is the U.S. troop presence in Iraq essential? Is it aggravating the situation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whether it's time for the U.S. to dig in or look to get out of Iraq. We've been joined by retired Army General William Odom, former director of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, 85 to 88. We're also joined by Thomas Barnett, former professor and senior strategic researcher in the Warfare Analysis and Research Department at the U.S. Naval War College, author of the forthcoming Blueprint for Action. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Don is calling from Florence, South Carolina. Hi, Don, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Ashbrook. Thank you for taking my call and for a wonderful program today.
You're welcome.
Just wanted to make a comment about Senator Hagel's comment. I believe that this is a watershed moment in the fight over Iraq, because I think Senator Hagel understands that by the time 2008 rolls around, since he is running for president, that the Republican Party is actually going to have to distance itself from the Bush policy in Iraq. And seeing that, he's bringing us back to a point that the great historian Daniel Boorstin once wrote about, that he said that governing without knowledge of history is like planting cut flowers. The Bush administration did not bother to look at the history of Vietnam when it went into Iraq. Now Senator Hagel is trying to remind them of that history, and by doing so, position himself in the strongest position to win the nomination in 2008.
Let us pick up those Hagel comments, and thanks for your call, Don. Tom Barnett, how about it? Here we've got a Republican senator from Nebraska, very likely, or at least a potential presidential candidate, two Purple Hearts and other honors he won for his service in Vietnam. And he's saying stay the course is not a policy, that we're not winning. The longer we stay, the more problems we're going to have. Is this the Republican Party breaking ranks with the president, or at least part of it, on Iraq?
Well, I think this is the limitation of imagination. I mean, this is the tendency of people of a certain age range to assume they've seen this situation before, and they call it Vietnam. But frankly, the analogies to Vietnam, I think, are just terribly off base. There we were talking about a bipolar situation where we had a major patron back in the opposition. In reality, what we have here is just the opposite. We have the potential to bring in great powers from the outside whose interest levels in the region are enormous. For example, Asia currently takes out roughly two-thirds of the oil that comes out of the Persian Gulf. So you can say it's our blood, but it's not exactly our oil. That percentage is going to rise dramatically over the next 20 years as Asia's energy requirements roughly double.
So are you saying Chinese soldiers are going to be sitting next to American soldiers at the oil wells around the Middle East?
I'm saying that will happen in the next 20 years. China, India, who's seen their own energy requirements skyrocket, Japan, United Korea down the road, they're all going to come to the Middle East militarily for the same reasons we did. The reality is now that we don't depend on Middle Eastern oil.
But we import something like 60% of our oil. General Odom, how about it? Tom Barnett
not
seems
from the
to
Middle East. Look, you don't have
understood. But Tom Barnett is describing the almost welcoming the Big Bang here, imagining it may be ultimately a controlled explosion. Things open up all over the place, and you've got soldiers from all over the place in to keep a lid on.
Let's put a red herring. Say you don't have to own a country to get it to sell you oil. Soviet Union hated us. They sold us oil. The Chinese and the Indians won't send their troops in there. They will buy the oil.
But they can't buy it if the oil wells are burning.
We were keeping him from selling it to us.
Now, they can't afford the oil at certain prices, and they can't afford the uncertainty. So for the same reasons the United States became interested in the region, the Chinese and the Indians are.
Look,
we've seen that already in terms of their relationship with Iran.
I mean,
look,
but this is an incredible picture.
You're not adding to the argument. You're just repeating an absurd red herring that's been out there to stir people up to think we have interests we don't.
That is, oil is not an American interest in the Middle East?
Owning it is not in our interest. Buying
only in an indirect sense, yes.
Well, I've never seen a country that had oil that wouldn't sell it.
Let's get a caller here. Sandro is calling from Hamilton, Canada. Hi, Sandro. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. My statement is basically this, that this discussion of an exit strategy and when to get out and this type of thing is, I think, is a decoy. When the United States was basically thrown out of Saudi Arabia for religious reasons, they got out primarily to protect the royal family and the roughly $900 billion worth of investment.
You mean when the U.S. troops were pulled out of Saudi Arabia? Yes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And where were they going to go to protect these interests? Basically, step two would be to protect the Saudi the royal family's interests in Iraq as to getting Saddam out to protect the royal family.
So you think they want to stay right there, but what about being thrown out of office in the United States? Chuck Hagel seems to have some concern about that if this policy loses public support. And what about the picture of chaos in the Middle East ensuing, not stability?
I think the as to your first point, the Republicans have so consolidated their power within the Congress and the Senate that it will be almost impossible for the Democrats to take over at that point, given the growth of the right in the United States and the Christian right. As to point two, what major nation with the military prowess of the United States would possibly go into a country like Iraq with no exit strategy? There's only one possible reason, that they have no intention of leaving.
Sandra, we've got it. Let me put it to General Odom to you. Do you see American politics levering U.S. troops out of Iraq? Sandro says no.
Well, if politics may not do it, but money, I think, is going to do it, and the shortage of troops is going to do it. Our capacity to supply Army troops to deal with this is in serious question. Now, the Chief Staff of the Army can't get up and say that vigorously, openly, but in fact, he said that something to the contrary, but he hasn't said that he can maintain any specific levels. So I think the administration is going to run up against objective, hard facts that make it very difficult to stay more than 6 months, 18 months.
In Iraq. Let's get another caller. Peter is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, I think that the administration failed to understand two things. They failed to understand the nature of Iraq, and they failed to understand Islam. I'd like to speak about both of them as the father of a reservist who came back from 10 months there. There are no Iraqi people. There are, as everyone has said, Sunnis and Shia and Kurds, and if you go back and you read Gertrude Bell in the 1920s, you see the resentments and the hatreds are not something of our making, and they're not something of Saddam Hussein's making.
We see that on display right now. And your second point, Peter?
The point there is when they say train the Iraqis, they're not training Iraqis. They're training
Shiites
Sunni
and
Shia. Mm-hmm. And the insurgency is not Sunni-led. It is entirely Sunni, based on two kinds of Sunnis, the old Ba'athists who don't want to lose power.
Peter, we've got it, and we know some of this, but our time is short. Should the U.S. stay or go?
When one says we are fighting a war on terror and we must stay the course, terror is a mere tactic. It's like saying we're fighting the Blitzkrieg. We are fighting against a worldwide jihad.
Stay or go.
The Islamization of Europe is far more important than letting Iraq descend into its natural state of civil war, which I suggest would be a good thing.
So bring the troops home or not?
Bring them home, yes, and let... It would be a mini Iran-Iraq war, which should have gone on, from the infidel point of view, forever.
Wow, there's a point of view. Peter, thank you very much for your call. I want to get an Iraqi voice in here. Joining us right now from Kingston, Jamaica, he's attending a conference there, is Faisal al-Istrabadi. He's Iraq's deputy ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
You must be very closely watching the debate that's growing in the United States about whether the U.S. should stand up, stay in Iraq until Iraqi forces can stand up and take over, or whether they should begin looking for the exits. What's your view?
Well, I think that it is in the vital American interest. It's clearly in the vital Iraqi interest, but it is also in the vital American interest, it would seem to me, that the United States position itself to withdrawing from Iraq when the Iraqis are able to provide for their own security.
But what if Iraqis are breaking into sects? We don't see that future. What if?
Well, I don't think. First of all, I think that particularly callers such as the very last caller who spoke have an extremely distorted view of Iraq. If Iraq were in fact descending into sectarian civil war and civil strife, there would be far more casualties than there have been. What we have are essentially two or three camps of fighters. One is foreign jihadists who are attracted to Iraq because the United States is there. They have, in fact, made this, as the president correctly said yesterday, a central front in the war on terrorism. Whether Iraq was a central front in March of 2003 is beside the point. In August of 2005, it is.
Ambassador, our time is short. Can the Sunnis be cowed or enticed into this highly autonomous federal Iraq, or are we going to see ongoing insurgency?
Well, I don't think that anyone can be cowed. The point of what is happening in Iraq now, in the new Iraq, no one is trying to cow anyone else.
I don't know about that. We read about death squads who are out there killing people every day. That sounds like cowing to me.
Well, that may be, but I don't think that if that's a strategy, then that's going to fail. And I don't. That is certainly not. That is certainly nobody's policy. If there are criminal gangs that are running death squads, then obviously they need to be dealt with accordingly.
How long do you think we'll need more than 100,000 U.S. troops in Iraq? How many more months or years?
I have no idea. You can't base it on time limits. You must base it on the capacity of the Iraqis to defend themselves. Do you want to give Al-Qaeda the opportunity of claiming that it defeated the United States in Iraq?
Let me put that question to General William Odom. General Odom, do you want to give Al-Qaeda that opportunity to make that claim?
Well, they'll make that claim. They're already making that claim. That's sort of beside the point. You better stop worrying about these public statements and who gets to cheer about them and figure out what your real power base is and how you can handle the next war. Being distracted in Iraq takes the heat off Al-Qaeda from us in Pakistan and Afghanistan. That's where our energies ought to be focused.
And Tom Barnett, to you finally, how many more years do you see 100,000 U.S. troops plus in Iraq?
We're about 150,000 Iraqi security forces trained at this point, and we're gearing up to about 250. The insurgency is going to grow in its strength, I would argue, through the end of this year, and we're going to see kind of a peaking of it probably over the first half of next year. As they move farther and farther in this constitutional process, it's going to seem more and more like a losing cause. No matter what the outcome, I agree with General Odom, Al-Qaeda will claim victory. They claim victory everywhere they go. They have absolutely no impact anywhere they go. They didn't defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan. The Mujahideen did. But they will always claim victory.
Our time is up here, but that sounds like an opportunity for some troops home just in time for midterm elections. It's been a fascinating conversation. Ambassador Faisal Al-Istrabadi, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thomas Barnett, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And General William Odom, always great to hear from you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the father of a fallen American soldier says Cindy Sheehan does not speak for him. This is On Point. Hundreds of people, including folk singer Joan Baez, have joined the anti-war protests begun by Cindy Sheehan outside President Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch. The mother of a fallen U.S. soldier, Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan has sparked similar protests around the country. A week and a half ago, we had Cindy Sheehan on the show. You can listen to that program at onpointradio.org. But not all parents of soldiers who have died in Iraq agree with Sheehan and her demand that U.S. troops be pulled out of Iraq. So we close with this different view from Ronald Griffin of Emerson, New Jersey, who lost his son, Specialist Kyle Griffin, in 2003.
I lost a son in Iraq, and Cindy Sheehan does not speak for me. I grieve with Mrs. Sheehan, for all too well, know the full measure of the agony she is forever going to endure. I honor her son for his service and sacrifice. However, I abhor all that she represents and those who would cast her as the symbol for parents of fallen heroes. The fallen heroes until now have enjoyed virtually no individuality. They have been treated as a monolith, a mere number. Now Mrs. Sheehan, with adept public relation tactics, has succeeded in elevating herself above the rest of us. Senator Bill Nelson of Florida declared that Mrs. Sheehan is now the symbol for all parents who have lost children in Iraq. Sorry, Senator, not for me. In a way, it heartens me to have all this attention paid to her, because that means others in her position now have the chance to be heard. Give equal time to other loved ones of fallen heroes. Feel the intensity of their love, their pride, and the sorrow. To many loved ones, there are few, if any, what-ifs. They, like their fallen heroes before them, live in the world as it is and not what it was or could have been. Think of the sacrifices that have been brought to us this day. We, as a country, made a collective decision. We must now live up to our decision and not deviate until the mission is complete. 35 years ago, a president faced a similar dilemma in Vietnam. He gave in, and what we got, peace with honor. To this day, I'm still searching for that honor. Today, those who defend our freedom every day do so as volunteers with a clear and certain purpose. Today, they have in their commander-in-chief someone who will not allow us to sink into self-pity. The amazing part about talking to the people left behind is that I did not want them to stop. After speaking to so many, I have come away with the certainty of their conviction that in a large measure it's because of the deeds and sacrifices of their fallen heroes that this is a better and safer world we now live in. Those who lost their lives believed in the mission. We honor their mission, and because it's right, we must believe in the mission too. We refuse to allow Cindy Sheehan to speak for all of us. Instead, we ask you to learn the individual stories. They are glorious. Honor their memories. Honor their service. Never dishonor them by giving in. They never did.
Army Specialist Kyle Andrew Griffin was killed in a truck accident on the road between Mosul and Tikrit in Iraq on May 30, 2003. His father, Ronald Griffin, lives in Emerson, New Jersey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.